From the studios of WICR at the University of Indianapolis, I'm Richard Brendan, and this is Journey's Fire. On this week's episode, my special guest is Maribai Bush. Maribai co-wrote a wonderful book called Walking Each Other Home, along with her close friend, Ram Dass. What would it look like if you could approach your own death with curiosity and love in service of other beings? Well, a lot of people resist their own mortality. But as Ram Dass often says, death is an incredible opportunity to awaken. Well, in this new book, Maribai and Ram explore the ways in which we can help ourselves and others leave this world consciously through masterful storytelling and practical guidance. These two gifted teachers offer an intimate, thoughtful, and uplifting exploration of the greatest of human mysteries. Maribai Bush is a founder and director of the Center for Contemplative Mind and Society and responsible for the Search Inside Yourself program at Google. She is co-author with Ram Dass of also Compassion in Action, and she lives in Massachusetts, and it's from beautiful Massachusetts she joins us today. Maribai, thank you so much for sharing your time with me today.
I'm happy to be here. I really admire what you've done so far.
Well, thank you. I've admired your work over the years as well. To set up this interview, I love Anne Lamott's sign off, I think, on this book when she writes, Ram Dass and Maribai Bush show us beautifully, deeply, and with such humor how profound and magical our lives can be as we become less and less afraid of death. This book is so needed. I'm sure you've heard that from countless people. And based on the 16 years I've had, my background as a hospice chaplain, yeah. There's still a mystery and a fear about it, isn't there?
And probably always will be.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Before we get started in the book, though, can you share how far back does your relationship go with Ram Dass, and where did it get started?
We met in India in 1970 at a Burmese monastery in Bodh Gaya.
That's a story right there.
Exactly. I had been a PhD student and been teaching at SUNY Buffalo, mm-hmm. and I was traveling, you know, in search of the meaning of life. I went all through Europe and the Middle East and Afghanistan and Pakistan and got to India and heard that there was a meditation course the first time. A Buddhist teacher was teaching a meditation course for Westerners. Mm-hmm. So I went there and I met Ram Dass there, and it was a real seed pod. Many people who came back then and started retreat centers around the country, people like Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg and Wes Nisker and many others, were all at that course. We all just happened to be there at the same time. And that was the beginning of my relationship with Ram Dass.
And you both studied under Maharishi. Did
yes.
you know? Yes.
Maharaji,
yes.
Who is Neem Karoli Baba,
yes.
and who Ram Dass has written about endlessly, but yes. starting with Be Here Now.
Yes, he has. As a matter of fact, I think it was a few decades later, because Krishna Dass has been on this program, and he talked about his experience. Went over there, same reason, came back, totally
yeah.
changed.
Yes, he was at that retreat also.
Ah.
And yes, and then stayed, as we did, for a couple of years.
Yeah.
He stayed even longer
yeah.
with Maharaji, yes.
I love this book because it's really a conversation between two friends. I mean, we're all facing our own death. I get that. Life and death is part of the same coin. But Ram Dass, with his health, he's in his 80s now. He knows that his time will be soon.
Yes.
And who initiated this project? I believe it was you, wasn't it?
It was. I'm on the board of Love, Serve, Remember Foundation, mm-hmm. which was we founded to support Ram Dass's teachings. As you probably know, 20 years ago he had a massive stroke, and he's incredible, and he really recovered quite a lot, but he's still paralyzed on one side, and he does have aphasia, so there's silences between his words often. He still teaches there in Maui where he lives. He can't travel. So we started a foundation to help him, to both preserve and spread more widely, I guess, make available Ram Dass's teachings and Neem Karoli Baba's teachings as well. Mm-hmm. And as we looked at, you know, Ram Dass has been writing and speaking really nonstop since he came back from India the first time. And before that, people have been telling me that he was a brilliant lecturer at Harvard. But, and so he's written about death, starting mm-hmm. to be here now in 1970. Mm-hmm. And so we first thought we would put together a lot of what he had written so that as the boomers get older, who was his first constituency, it would be available for people. But I did that, and then I wrote, and he said, well, I want you to be part of this book, too. So I said, okay, I'll write a long introduction, you know. And so I did, and I gave him his collected writings and an introduction. And he said, this is so like him, it's so sweet. He said, you know, I like your part better than my part. So I said, okay, maybe we can do something here. Furthermore, I really, although the words are almost all the same, from the beginning, uh-huh. we know it's very different to be able to speak the words and then have lived a life of coming into more intimate knowing yeah. of those words.
Yeah.
And I wanted to capture what, you know, how he's holding it now, which is quite different from when he mm-hmm. first started talking. Mm-hmm. So I started out just us having these conversations, mm-hmm. and then people were saying to me, oh, I wish I could be there with you when you're talking to Ram Dass. And so I thought, well, this is a way to bring everybody in.
Yes.
So
yes.
That's how it happened.
And that's exactly how I felt. And by the way, when he said to you, I like your part better than my part, how many top-level teachers would say that to someone else?
Someone who's just written an introduction. You know?
Yeah, uh-huh. That's pretty cool right there. Well, in his preface, he writes, dying is the most important thing you do in your life. It's the great frontier for every one of us. And then he says, if you know how to live and to love, you'll know how to die. Let's revisit that part about dying is the most important thing you do in his life. What did he mean by that?
Well, I think that he meant, Ram Dass, of course, believes in reincarnation.
Yes.
So the simple answer to that is, and it's not just in religions that believe in reincarnation. I grew up as a Catholic, and the last moments are also extremely important because either you imagine that you are going to be reincarnated, so how you enter that next realm conditions who you will be in your next lifetime, and that's the kind of simple thing that Ram Dass is saying there. But all religions say that, you know. You know how in Catholicism you can be forgiven for all your sins at the last moment before you die, because it's so important to die in an open, peaceful, loving, accepting space.
Yes. Yes. That is so crucial, and I think people underestimate that. I've often learned in hospice that we also die as we live.
Yes, that really came up a lot. And I talk about how being with my sister as she was dying, and she had dementia, which of course complicates things, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. Although in another way it simplifies things. But and she had a lot of regrets, and I hadn't really thought much about regrets before that. I mean, sometimes I'd be sitting around with friends and say, oh, I wish I hadn't done that, mm-hmm, you know. Mm-hmm. But she would say, through her dementia, I wasn't a good enough mother, you know. And it was so yeah. poignant, you know. Yeah. And then we would say to her, her daughter and I spent a lot of time with her, we'd say, you are a wonderful mother. And then simply partly because she had dementia and she couldn't, like, have an argument in her own mind, she said, oh, and and then she just settled back into the pillows, you know. But I saw the difference between those two states when you're really, you know, struggling with feeling you didn't use your life in the best way that you could have. So I want to be able to feel that I did my best, you know, and that I have, you know, forgiven and asked forgiveness.
Yes.
And reflected on my life enough to be able to accept it as it has been.
To live a life of no regrets.
Exactly.
So you don't have any. What, by the way, what has been your experience in your life of death?
I have never died. But as one of the reviewers of the book said, if you or anyone you know is in danger of dying someday, you really need this book.
Well, I've been on a few stages where I've died. I remember those experiences.
Oh. Yeah, I've never done that. But my father died when I was still in college.
Oh, okay.
My mother died in the 80s, and I was very close to her, and this is a classic story, I'm sure you know. I was with her for the last 48 hours, and then I was finally so tired. She was in the hospital. I walked to the end of the hall, and there was a solarium, and I lay down for 20 minutes, and I came back, and she had gone.
Yes.
And I know that's quite common, and I can easily imagine that, if my family and dear ones were around me, I would have a hard time leaving.
Yeah.
So I was very close to that death. And then really to one more who was Mary McClellan, a great artist, and married to Dave McClellan, who was the head of social psychology at Harvard and when Ram Dass was there and then later. And a group of us lived together for some years in the 70s. And I went through her death. But recently, I put a little table in my meditation room to put pictures on of people who died because I knew I wasn't going to forget them, but I wanted to be, you know, reminded and to check in with them, you know. And the table is really full now. It's just, you know, as you get older.
Yes.
I'm
discovering that.
Yeah.
And what I'm learning also is the power of death awareness. I've always believed now that the awareness of death truly is the secret of life if we can learn how to embrace our own mortality.
Yes, yes. It really makes a difference. It really makes you appreciate, that's not a strong enough word, but, you know, every moment, every day. I mean, of course we intellectually know that we're all going to die someday. And when we're young, we think we're not going to die for a long time. But just really holding it. I'll tell you that working on the book, it took us 2 years because I had to go back and forth to Maui. But it gave me 2 years where this was foremost in my consciousness, you know. Thinking about it, talking about it, reading everything I could find. And although I wasn't specifically doing it to get rid of my fear of death and to bring death more intimate, that's what happened, of course. And I feel so different now. I feel so much lighter and easier.
I love that.
Yeah.
That is so true. You know, I don't know Ram Dass, but from what I've read of his writings, it seems like he's been able to learn how to walk on the earth lightly.
Really?
He allows things, he allows that flow to take place. And now, towards the end of his life, he's had, you know, strokes and health issues and such. But it seems like he's not afraid of that. He's embracing it.
He really is unafraid now.
Yeah.
But I want to say that it takes, you know, wasn't always that way, as I said, when he could write about it in the beginning, and he had some like death-like experiences through psychedelics. And And he had a number of close friends who died, who he writes wonderful stories about Aldous Huxley and Tim Leary and so on in the book. But the stroke really, of course, took him the closest. He almost did die, and he couldn't deny anymore that, you know, any moment death comes without warning.
Mm-hmm.
And so that he just deepened into it so much after that. He is, I mean, I can say, I don't know how many people I can say this about, but he is unafraid, absolutely.
Yes, that's the impression I get. And I can only imagine what it's like to just be in his presence. It sounds like there's just great power and beauty and love there.
Yeah, there's lots of love.
Yeah,
and actually what I liked about doing the book in this format was that he's also just really present, ordinary guy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, at the same time that he has really worked through so much and really is so just a stream of love now.
Mm-hmm.
And he's always like brought those both aspects of himself into his teaching, but now it's so clear.
Yeah. It's always amazing to me, Maribai, that when I think about our educational system, some of the subjects that we never teach our kids are things like love,
yeah,
are things like how to live fully, and certainly we don't teach death, and yet those are the most important things we ought to be learning at an early age.
Kids are so curious about death.
Yes, they are.
We had our dog died this year.
Hmm.
It was a big, wonderful, fluffy Samoyed, and my granddaughter, who was 8, at the time, she was so interested in the whole thing. She loved Nadine, you know. And when Nadine died, she just buried her face in Nadine's fur, you know. And she was unafraid to be close to her, even after she died. And then we had a little funeral, and she called her friends, and they came, and we buried her in the garden, and they brought... they dropped flowers all over her, and then they, Dahlia wrote a poem. This is a 7-year-old poem. Nadine is sweet. Nadine was kind. Nadine will have a great rewind.
I love that.
So, and it was all without, you know, there was, I didn't see fear in the kids.
Yeah.
They were being with something very natural that happened. There was sadness, but not fear.
Yeah, we end up picking that stuff up as we get older, it seems like.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of fear, though, you write in your book, one afternoon we met again over tea, and Ram Dass says, "When I'm afraid of something, I come up close to it as possible, and I notice my resistance. I allow myself to just notice the resistance, because the resistance intensifies the fear. There's no doubt about it. Get as close to the fear as you can, noticing the boundaries of it, just being with it, seeing it as it is. Don't grab, don't push it away, just notice." Boy, such wisdom.
Gotten that passage.
I'm reminding you how great you are.
No, but that's so true, and how much we want to push it away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And just being brave enough to just see it. For that's why the insight practices, mindfulness, and so on, are so helpful in, you know, being able to bring your attention back over and over again to something without moving away. And of course, when you learn those practices, you don't start with something you're terrified of. But I teach incoming first year students at Amherst College, so they have a 3-day intensive orientation, and I usually start with giving them each a leaf and having them bring their attention back to the leaf. And first, you know, they look at it and they say, "Okay, I see it." And then coming back again and again, and what more is there to see? And how much do you how restless are you getting? I've looked at this already, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. And just over, and you know, 10 minutes can be an eternity for 18-year-olds, and you know, that practice is what really teaches us how to be with the things that we really don't want to be with, our fears.
It does take, I think, deep spiritual practice. Of course, you have that covered also towards the end of the book, too. And by the way, for those listening, I've read a lot of books like this because I'm fascinated by this topic. That's why this show is called Dying to Live. I love this book in particular because it is a conversation between two beautiful souls who've walked on this earth for a while, who knows a little bit of a lot of things, and you literally are invited in to this conversation, and we need more conversations about this because
yes.
Death is the most democratic thing on the face of the earth, man. It's going to take Democrats and Republicans.
Yes.
Maybe libertarians. I'm not sure about that.
Right. They may find another way.
I'm sure they will.
I know a lot of them out in Silicon Valley.
Well, you ask him a question, a very profound question, and you say, what else helps with fear? And here's what I love about this. You write, when you ask that, Ram Dass is quiet. He just gets quiet for a while. And then you say, he seems to be drifting off. Then he says, India, the burning Ghats. And can you share what he learned in India about death and about the dying? Because that's the other thing, I think, is it's depending on the cultures around the world, we experience death differently, don't we?
So differently. India. He went to India the first time in a trip before I met him.
Mm-hmm.
And he went with a friend, and they were on a more of a cultural tour of India. And he went to Benares, is one of the oldest continually inhabited cities in the world, and they went there, and Ram Dass was walking around, and Benares is also the place where Hindus, where it's the most auspicious place to die for Hindus, and the understanding is that if you die there, then you will, you'll be off the wheel of life. You will. Mm. You won't have any more incarnations.
Mm-hmm.
And so many people go there to die, and many of those people are very poor people, and they're just sometimes just sitting on the street, you know. And of course, they're waiting to die, so they're looking really awful, you know. And so Ram Dass walked around Benares that first time, and he said he was so freaked out that he may not have ever seen, like, he saw his mother in the hospital before she died, but of course it's all very cleaned up. And so he said he was outraged, you know, why is this happening? You know, they should be taken care of. This is awful. And he said he went back to his hotel room, and he actually crawled under the bed. He was so freaked out. He had never told me that before we had this conversation.
Wow, yeah. Uh-huh.
So then he met his teacher, Neem Karoli Baba, and then he was back in Benares, and he said that time he had an entirely different take on it. That time, he said he walked through the streets and he realized that these people were exactly where they wanted to be. They had they had done the pilgrimage and they got to the end and they were just waiting to go home.
Hmm.
And they were looking at him. He thought, you know, as if he were this, you know, kind of Westerner who was completely lost and wandering around, didn't know what he was doing, and feeling sorry for him. So, and then that trip, he also sat by the burning ghats, which are these big fires, funeral pyres, mm-hmm. in India by the river Ganges, and people bodies are burned. It's a very... Have you done it? Have you been there?
No, I have not.
It's, as you can imagine, a very profound experience.
Yes.
I mean, I've been with bodies that are being burned in crematoria, but, you know, it's pretty clinical. This is just all out in the open, and you watch, and you can smell the flesh burning. And my experience was that I was sitting there breathing, of course, in and out, but I realized I was breathing the smoke that had come from burning this body. And I thought, oh my God, we're all interconnected, but here, right now, I'm like interconnected with this person by breathing him in. It was kind of a moment for me of just letting go of a lot of the ways that I thought things were.
A dear friend of mine had that similar experience in Bali. They would have certain traditions like that over there. And she would stop and just watch and observe and experience. And, you know, those things just don't happen here in the States.
No.
Yeah, when you talk about, well, first of all, I think one of the most famous Ram Dass quotes is walking each other home. I see that plastered all over Instagram and Facebook.
Yeah,
and
I know it. I didn't realize it was until we... I mean, he's been saying it for years. And
yes.
It was great because we didn't have a title. Yeah. Like, our working title was, I think, Love and Death.
Pretty basic.
So we didn't know what we were going to. We were playing around with different things. And then I loved the moment because it was like, oh, yeah, you've been saying it all this time. It's been waiting for a book to attach to.
Yeah, you know what? I'm surprised that hadn't come out until now.
I know.
It's a perfect title for that.
There are lots of T-shirts.
Well, it also reminded me, and you talk about this briefly in the book, I forgot that he helped Stephen Levine and I think Dale Borgum with the Living Dying Project.
Yes.
Which is really all about that.
Oh, absolutely. And you will appreciate this, because at the time, well, the hospice movement hadn't really started yet then. Mm. That was the early 70s.
Yeah, right.
And so Ram Dass and Stephen, they had this idea, okay, we're going to use the process of dying as also a process of spiritual growth. And the people who are there, you know, will be doing that, and also the hospice workers, and will create an environment that's most conducive for that, and so on. And they found a really nice place, and they... in the beginning, I think there were five people, maybe. Mm-hmm. And they were just everyone was being very kind and loving, and they were trying to find the absolute best foods and other, you know, care interventions. And after a while, it kept on going and going. And at a certain point around that time, nobody's dying. They all had kind of a second wind because they liked being there so much.
Yes. You know, that's funny because I've learned that in hospice, too. If a person who's been pronounced terminal, but they're getting all this extra TLC and loving energy, oftentimes they have to be taken off service because they've improved. Yeah. Well, that's funny the way he said that, though. It's like, yeah. There's also a section in here, and of course he's always been about love his whole life. The antidote to fear is love.
Yeah.
What did you learn from your conversations from Ram Dass about love in relation to death?
Well, what we talked about and what my experience has been is when you're in the space of love, of moving toward unconditional love. Mm-hmm. If you're just there and you're loving, there's no place left for fear.
Mm-hmm.
You're just fully loving, and you're not afraid. And so, I mean, it was like that. Our teacher, Neem Karoli Baba, didn't give us philosophical or religious teachings. He spoke very little. His presence was very, very powerful. But he said, love everyone, serve everyone.
Yeah.
And, but being with him he said that, and many people could say that to you, and you say, sure, I'll try.
Mm-hmm.
But being with him, we experienced being in this space of just love, loving ourselves, each other, him, you know, just being love. And, of course, then we had to spend the rest of our lives figuring out how to, you know, increase it in our ordinary lives. But there was no fear. And so what we've encouraged people to do is just, whether you were, you know, on the short road to dying or at whatever time in your life, you know, the more in which you can increase your love, care, kindness, compassion for all beings and the earth, the less you'll be afraid of it.
Yeah. That is part of understanding that death is over your shoulder. Something else you address in there. As a matter of fact, in your conversation with Ram Dass, you say, you tell him about a plumber I know who almost died from cancer, and each time he says goodbye to someone, he imagines the last time so that he can be as loving as he wanted to be when he thought he was dying. That is so true, isn't it?
Yeah.
If we can live that way.
I know it. And every time a close friend dies, I, you know, my automatic response when I talk to our other friends in common is like, don't die. I love you. Don't die.
Yeah.
But, you know, when that happens, you're so aware. after the book came out, I showed the plumber that I put it in there. He was so happy. He was incredible. You know, I just thought, if I didn't do anything else with this book, I made one person really, really happy.
And I bet he bought a lot of copies, too. What has been your hardest death to experience in your life so far?
Well, in the last year, I lost two people who were really close to me. And I haven't experienced a lot of resistance or anger or frustration. You know, they're gone, why? I've experienced sadness and a kind of an appreciation we all go when it's our time. But I have experienced the space where they are not. We talk about how, you know, you have a new relationship with people when they die, that their soul still, you know, with you, and you have a different relationship, and I feel that with both these folks. But I also feel a sadness. I was just, one of them lived in New York, and I just went to New York last week, and it was the first time I'd been in the city without visiting her. And, you know, there was like an emptiness around it, and it was sad. And I miss her, and I miss the part of myself that came alive with her. It's slightly different from the space I share with each of my other friends.
Yeah.
So they're hard for me in a new way. I don't feel devastated. I feel accepting and, still sad.
I read a book many years ago. He has now since passed. John O'Donohue wrote a book called, and he'd been on the show before.
I love him.
I do too. And you know, passing away at 53, that was another reminder to me. Richard, nothing lasts forever. You never
that
know.
That was a shock. He was a good friend as well as colleague. You know, I first met him in Galway before he came here. And he was a real wisdom holder.
Yeah.
I loved him.
Mirabai, you know great people. I got to hang out with you sometime.
Now I know you.
Well, I remember in his book, Beauty, the Invisible Embrace, he had a chapter on death, and he said this, because I've witnessed this so much with the hospice work I've done, that when a person dies in a bed, it becomes so much more than that. It becomes a sacred altar where there's a spiritual transformation from physical to the spiritual. And, you know, everything John writes is like poetry.
Yes.
But I thought about that when I was reading your book, because Ram Dass talks a lot about from ego to soul. He said, dying is about moving from ego to soul, leaving the body and becoming the soul. Well, what did he mean by that?
Well, I asked him that.
Yes, you did. I'm leading you on.
because many people's understanding, there are a lot of different understandings of what soul is.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all related, but... Mm-hmm. And Ram Dass has a pretty... traditional Hindu understanding that the soul is that of spirit which never dies, and that it exists in each individual, and then when you die, it becomes part of the spirit which is everything, but it also retains its... The language is difficult because it doesn't really... The language is all about the material world, but it retains its identity. Although, you know, often people will say when you die, you lose your identity, you know, and then you go on to that which is boundless.
Mm-hmm.
His understanding is that in between lives, the soul leaves the body, and the soul then joins with others with whom you have been connected through many lives. And so, I think Catholics think that your family and close friends will be there waiting for you in
mm-hmm.
heaven.
Mm-hmm.
This is, Ram Dass says, believes that there will be a soul pod. I love that.
Yeah, I do too.
The soul pod, and that there you will meet the people who are really karmically close to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that might include your blood family or your spouse. It also might include people you've been close to in different ways in your life. And it kind of gives a... we all know those people we've met, and we know them already, and it's as if we had been together before, but we hadn't been. And sometimes you then end up doing something for a long time with that person, whatever it happens to be, you know, marrying them, working with them, being friends with them. But sometimes you don't even do that. But that experience of, like, meeting someone who's so familiar and without having known anything about them, that's always like, you know, it's a related to a deja vu experience. But I think that those... Those folks will be in the soul pod.
Yeah. My fantasy is in my soul pod one day will be both John O'Donohue and Jimmy Buffett. I would love that soul pod. That would be totally rad, wouldn't
that
it?
That is so great.
Let's talk about something else that really is an issue for so many of us, and that's attachments.
Mm-hmm.
And Ram Dass says it's freeing. He says aging is freeing, fewer attachments. And then he talks about how he used to comb his hair and how he doesn't care anymore. And actually, I found that to be true, too. The older I get, the less attachments I'm having as well.
Yeah, but that's not true for everyone.
No, it's not. No.
So, many people, I think maybe, well, especially women, around appearance and combing your hair and so on,
mm-hmm.
have a real struggle with... hard because the culture is so, you know, youth-focused.
Yeah.
It's hard as you're getting old. Attachment to, well, it starts, I don't know if it's a start, but how you used to look.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
somewhat superficial, but you are reminded of it every day.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you are.
And especially now that so many photos are being taken everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, all of our attachments are, you know, whatever there too, we talk about, you know, attachment as you're really getting ready to die, your attachment to your family. Mm-hmm. And which is not to say that, mm-hmm. you know, you shouldn't love your family or your close friends or your spouse, whoever. But it's that to be able to hold that love and also the understanding that it's going to end at some point. One of you will die before the other. And it's okay. And so just as I said, like the basic practice of giving up attachment is seeing what arises, noticing if you are, you know, if you're pushing it away or holding on to it, and then just breathing and letting go and just seeing it as it is right now here in this moment. And, you know, that's a lifetime's work.
It truly is. And the sooner we can begin to work on that,
yeah,
the better for us when it's our time to go.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I remember in that very first meditation course, it was with a Burmese teacher called Goenka. And he talked about, I don't like, you know, and then, you know, coming into our minds, like, what do I, and I remembered, I don't like peas. And then I thought, oh my God, I have like put a lot of energy into identifying myself as a person who doesn't like peas. And I would never accept them from anybody. I can't eat that. I don't like peas.
Yeah.
I made myself eat some fun. And when I realized that, I mean, it was so, you know, it was so, such a frivolous thing to put so much energy into. And I just remember laughing when I saw it. And then later, I ate some peas, and they were fine. I still didn't, they weren't my favorite food, but it didn't matter, you know. So, yeah, we get attached to things, and we spend a lot of energy paying attention to that. Mm-hmm. And just mm-hmm. when you let go, you know, like we all know, having like maybe had a bad relationship or an angry exchange with someone, and then after a while, however you do it, it's gone, you let go. And you feel so much better because you're spacious. You're able to just be in the moment and not be carrying that thing around with you that constricts you. Mm. So, yeah, all of that, remembering that we're going to die is a good reminder to let go of attachment if you need another reminder. You know?
It absolutely is. And because everything dies, I love that word impermanence now mm-hmm. more than ever, there's going to come grief. Mm-hmm. And he even talks about that. I want to bring something up, though, because this is woven throughout your conversations with him throughout this book. And you word it in various ways. But in this section called From Mourning to Remembering, you start off and say, we sit in silence for a while. And that just felt so peaceful to me when I would read that. And that often would take place in your conversations with him.
You know, people often ask me, was that hard for you? You know, Ram Dass often would just stop talking and be, you know. And I said, no, it wasn't hard at all. It was really great.
Yeah.
But with silence, in those silences, it wasn't a silence of trying to figure out what should come next or having the mind wander off into some totally other subject.
Yes.
It was just being together in silence. So great.
And we all will go through loss of some kind. What was his wisdom regarding the grief process?
Many people have come to him, of course. Mm-hmm. You know, people come to him in times of difficulty for wisdom. And lots of times people feel guilty about grieving, especially if it's been going on for a while. And the first thing he always says is, yes, grieve. It's a natural human response to having lost someone you love. Someone you love, or something in yourself that's gone that you are now, you know, grieving. Grieve, and that grief comes to everyone in different forms and has a different timing for everyone. And sometimes just when you think you're on the other side, that, you know, then it comes back powerfully. And that grieving doesn't, it leads to an incorporation of the, if it's the grief of the loss of a person, of being with that person, holding that person in a different way, recognizing that they're not in their body anymore, but they are here, and that there is a, you know, a spiritual or spirit-based loving relationship that you can have, and in those times, grieving changes into a different way of being with. And speaking of John O'Donohue, I had put his poem on grieving in that section.
Yes, you did.
And the book is beautifully designed. I think Sounds True did a really nice job. And it's nice to hold, and the illustrations are lovely. But it's also available both on CDs and as a download. And here's the great thing, that Sounds True owned the rights to John reading that poem.
Oh.
And so the audio, Ram Dass does the preface in his voice, but he couldn't do much more because of his aphasia.
Yeah.
So I read the rest of it in my voice. And then, but when we get to grieving, we have John O'Donohue reading his poem. So great.
From the grave.
Yes. Perfect.
Very perfect. And the other thing that was perfect is it seemed like every time then you would leave, your conversation, your day, your evening was done. And towards the end of the book, you close out with that. You're getting ready to go. You say it's time for dinner, and as I open the door to leave, Ram Dass calls out and says, I love you.
Yeah.
He says that a lot, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And I want to thank you also for having, at the end, a Practices for Conscious Living, being with the dying and your own death. I think that's really important, and our listeners will get a lot of good wisdom from that as well. A beautifully done book. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you. I love talking to you. Didn't feel like an interview. It felt, again, like two old friends talking about something important.
Thank you. I feel the same way. We'll have you back on the show again. And for more information about this book and also about the work that you're doing, please share your web address.
My address is mirabaibush.com, and Ram Dass's is ramdass.org.
Mirabai Bush, thank you so much. It's been a joy. You know, for 16 and a half years, actually more than that, I've been on this radio station, WICR. I've had a lot of great guests. Here's an excerpt from an interview I did. I believe it was my first interview I did with the great best-selling author, Neil Donald Walsh. One thing you say repeatedly in different ways throughout the book is all behaviors are the result of beliefs, which is why it's so important to challenge the beliefs that we've had, which are causing events that aren't working for us.
That is correct. There is not a single behavior that is not sponsored by a belief behind it. And what we've been trying to do for the past several thousand years is alter human behavior at the level of behavior. That is, we've been trying to change things through what we would call behavior modification. And the most brutal form of behavior modification is, I have a bigger stick than you do, and I'm going to hit you with my stick if you don't stop hitting me with yours. and so we drop bombs, or we apply economic pressure, or political pressure, or all three, on each other in an attempt to change behaviors, rather than doing what is the painfully obvious thing to do, which is to direct our attention to the beliefs that sponsor the behaviors that we would seek to change. But no one seriously does that because beliefs are sacred cows. We don't want to touch our belief systems. We would rather hang on to our belief systems even when they're not working, even when they're killing us.
Now, here in the United States, we're waiting perhaps any day to hear word of what we're going to be doing with Iraq. Has a lot to also do with politics, and you say that politics is spirituality demonstrated. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, the words speak for themselves. Politics is the demonstration of our highest spiritual thoughts. Economics is a demonstration of our spirituality. Everything that we do in life, in fact, demonstrates what we believe about God and about ourselves, about each other, and about life itself. So, in truth, there is no part of life that is not an aspect of or a demonstration of our spirituality. And politics is that profoundly. If politics is not a demonstration of our beliefs, then what is it? And beliefs is just another word for spirituality. It's what we think about God and about life, even if our thoughts about God are that there is no God. That still is our thought about God. That's our spirituality. And so politics is a demonstration of our spirituality. If we would look at it that way and just announce it and get it over with, which I have to give credit, there are some countries that actually do that, but we have a tradition here of pretending to separate church and state. Mm-hmm. But separation of church and state is not the same as separating politics and spirituality, because a church is not the same as spirituality. Religion, or a church, is an organization that tells us what to believe. Spirituality, on the other hand, is a deep inner personal experience that allows us to construct our own awareness and come to clarity about our own highest truth. And so spirituality, that is, our own highest truth, should never be separated from politics. But religion, that is an organization that has a particular point of view, definitely should be separated from politics. So separation from church and state makes complete sense and always has in the United States. But separation of politics and spirituality is not the same thing at all. We are asking that our highest thoughts about life and how it is, our highest thoughts about human beings and how we relate to each other, and our highest thoughts about God, whatever those thoughts might be the basis of all of our political actions. If that were to happen, the world would change overnight.
Neil, in your book, you also talk about 10 fallacies that are causing our belief system to create behaviors that don't work, 5 fallacies about God and 5 fallacies about life. I know we don't have time to get into all 10 right now. Your book does a very good job of that. But what can you say to speak to those fallacies that you lay out in the book?
Well, I think they're profound statements of enormous errors that human beings have made and are continuing to make, and that I've made all of my life, and all of us have, mm-hmm. As we come to our understandings about God and about life. And they drive the engine of our experience. I'll just use one of the 10. You're right, we don't have time for 10, but the most important one is the very first one. We have an idea that God somehow needs something from us. And so the first fallacy is that God needs something from human beings in order to be happy. And as long as we imagine that, we will imagine that God is either angry or not angry, either pleased or displeased with us, depending upon whether we meet God's needs. Of course, there are 1,000 different viewpoints on how to meet God's needs. There is the Islamic viewpoint, there's the Christian viewpoint, there's the Jewish viewpoint, there's the Mormon viewpoint, and the Hindu viewpoint, and so on and so forth. And so it's kind of like pick a card, any card. But if you pick the wrong card, it's like Russian roulette. You go straight to hell. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Proceed straight to hell. And so we need to be real clear that the God of this universe has no needs. That is one of the 9 new revelations, that God is not a super being living somewhere inside the universe or outside of it, subject to the same emotional turmoils and having the same emotional needs as human beings, that God needs nothing and requires nothing in order to be happy, that God is happiness itself, and therefore, by definition, requires nothing of anyone or anything in the universe. Once we can get off of this, once we can step away from this idea that we have to somehow perform certain rituals or act in a certain way in order to keep God happy, then we can suddenly begin to step away also from our own righteousness with regard to how to do that. The idea that God needs something is a primitive idea. It came to us in the early and most primitive days of human beings, has been captured in the mythologies of those early days, and been passed on to us in the form of the doctrines in organized religion. in the earliest days. We didn't understand why we had earthquakes or the sun baked us for 40 days straight, or we didn't have, no rain, or conversely, it rained for 40 days and we had floods everywhere. We didn't understand why the world was the way it was, especially nature. We presumed that these outcomes of nature were the results of the anger of the gods, and so we made sacrifices to the gods in order to placate the gods. We even burned our own children on pyres of fire. Later, we burned animals instead. We had these terrible sacrifices in order to appease gods who we imagined required appeasement. And religion is nothing more than a modern version of God appeasement. How can we appease an angry deity and please God by performing these rituals in this way, bowing to the east, or making the sign of the cross, or failing to eat pork, or whatever it is we imagine that we have to do, that God is going to be upset about if we don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so religion turns out to be our attempt to appease an otherwise angry God and to mollify him. I'm suggesting in the New Revelations, and God is suggesting through me, that you've got God all wrong. We don't have to appease anybody, therefore we don't have to fight with each other over the best way to do that.
And so you write in your book that the five fallacies about God and the five fallacies about life create crisis, violence, killing, and war.
Well, sure, because we think that our survival's at stake. If you think your survival's at stake, you're going to fight everyone around you who's not doing it your way, because we all want to survive. It's the survival instinct kicking in at the highest level. If we think that the guy next to us is offending...
And as today's program, I want to thank you for joining me. A reminder that all shows are podcast on my site, richardbrendan.com. And so, for engineer Genesis Brown and production coordinator Angel Richardson, I'm Richard Brendan. You've been listening to Journey's Fire. We're bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.